This is episode 6 of the Software Freedom Law Show.
So here we are, finally back in the same place for the podcast.
And we are literally not phoning it in.
That's correct. Yeah, that's what we had to do last time, and you were sick, but that was fine. It worked out well. I think we actually got some really good feedback about Evan's speech. People on Identica seemed to like it, and we're glad to hear it. And I was glad we had some material to give them an introduction to general issues about copyright and patent system and where it came from.
Yeah, I think it was a good foundation. Actually, what we're going to talk about this week is a bit of a foundation as well. And when I said we're not phoning it in, it's in part also because we don't have a guest today.
And we don't have some big long speech by somebody else that we didn't have to do any work and just added it or anything like that.
So today, Bradley and I are just going to talk about some of the licensing issues that concern us.
Yeah, we actually have to do work today. We have to work. We'll have to explain something to our faithful listeners and teach them something. We got to learn them something today.
Is that the Baltimore?
Probably, but you know, we're gonna educate the free software community about an important licensing topic, and our topic today is.
He's looking at me as if I'm supposed to say, so I will. So the topic today is exceptions.
Exception, it's an exceptional show.
Well, we hope so.
Well, we actually don't know yet. That's right. Yeah. So this is a concept that you get it's one of these things that you get really used to when you spend a lot of time studying what a license of various programs are and what the details of the licensing rules are. So for me, I just got used to this idea, but it's actually a somewhat foreign idea, I think, to people in the free software world, because usually they look at, you know, the Free Software Foundation's list or the OSI list of approved open source licenses, and they think, well, those are the choices. Those are the ways that I can license my open source and free software.
Right, and coming at it as a lawyer, you know, we think, well, what are the whole range of possibilities that we can use in order to accomplish the licensing goals that you want? So basically, if you're writing some software, you can choose whatever terms that you want to distribute it under. And that could be a whole host of things. And I think what people hear about a lot of the time are a very small set of the licenses that are around, and there's good reason for that.
Yeah, of course, the immediate objection that people are going to have when you say that is, well, what about this whole issue of license proliferation?
Right.
What about this idea that there are just too many free software and open source licenses, and we're trying to get to a small core of licenses that everybody agrees are correct? And the thing is that the idea of exceptions that we're going to talk about actually isn't in contradiction with that, as it turns out. In fact, the exceptions make it possible to have, a smaller body of licenses, as it turns out.
The exceptions give flexibility to the licenses that are already in existence to cover individual and particular situations that that you might not be able to draft a general license to cover. So, you know, some of the licenses that we were used to seeing, I think maybe we were saying the other day that there were maybe 6 licenses.
Probably
generally that you would want to choose from that would
cover. You can go probably to 10, but 6 to 10 are probably.
Yeah, that would cover most of the situations that you would look
for. And the
needs,
you know, the things that free software developers feel that they need from a license as far as protecting the freedom of their software and their, you know, facing patents and all these other things. There's basically 6 to 10 different ways to solve all those problems. And then those are basically solved by the licenses we have. But sometimes a particular system or software package causes a bit of a problem. And I think maybe now might be a good time to talk about an example, which was actually, this is actually the first example that I discovered where an exception was necessary. So there was a time, fortunately, we're long past this time, when there was this programming language that was really popular called Visual Basic. It was a horrible, sad, terrible time for programmers where code lines and lines in code in this horrible, awful language were being written. But the thing is, programs are programs, right? And they're free software programs everywhere, even on Microsoft systems writing Visual Basic. So when I first started working at the FSF and answering, one of my first jobs was just answering email, the general email sent to the FSF with inquiries, people would say, I want to GPL my Visual Basic code. And the first answer was, oh, great, you know, just GPL it. But then you run into a problem, which is that the runtime library, which is sort of the standard library, and if you know C programming, that would be something like glibc. If you know, basically Python or Perl, there's the standard libraries that come with those. Well, Visual Basic has a standard library that comes with it. And you have to combine your program with that standard library. It's one work. That library alongside the code you wrote to make the thing do something, to make the final binary program.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can probably guess, Karen, what the licensing terms on Visual Basic's library were, don't you think?
Yeah, I assume they were... I assume they were incompatible.
They were well beyond incompatible. The ultimate in non-freeness, of course. You don't get the source code to the thing. So, of course, any source code provision in GPL where it says you have to give the source code to the user, well, you didn't even get the source code to Visual Basic's libraries when you got it.
Right.
So you've got nothing with regard to those libraries to comply with the GPL with. So the first response people have is, well, fail. You know, I can't license my stuff under GPL. But
well,
that's
and I think actually just to separate, I think, or to step back for a second, I think this is actually a good general story, too, to show what goes into a lot of licensing questions as and the kind of diligence that you have to do.
Right.
Because you can't just say, oh, well, you wrote this software, you know, go ahead and GPL it. There are often a lot of questions that you have to ask before you can do that. So, and sorry, that was a little
aside. It's a really good point, because this for many years, and now there's, you know, other proprietary languages out there, I assume. I try never to touch them, but particularly with Visual Basic, there was a lot of people writing in it, and they want to dip their toe in the free software world, so they want to try the GPL, but then they run into this problem. So the first thing you think is, well, I can't do this because GPL won't allow me. You know, but it's not that GPL won't allow you, of course, because you're the copyright holder.
Right. There's an important distinction there, because I think a lot of people don't necessarily understand that that the licensing comes from the originator, comes from the author, it comes from the person who is writing that software. So if you write software, you can choose whatever licensing terms that you want. So
it's a good point. So they could, in reality, it wouldn't be wrong per se, from their point of view, as the person who wrote the program, to GPL the software, right? I mean, they could put the GPL on.
Mm-hmm. But then they would have a problem as...
Right. But that's the interesting thing, because they would later run into a problem, not for themselves, because they can say, well, I put it under GPL, I have every right, I chose the license. And they could also put it under a license that said, well, if you want to run this program, you have to, or if you want to modify this program, you have to do it while standing on your head and spinning around. Right. Well, is anybody actually going to be successful in modifying the program while standing on their head and spinning around? Probably not. So, ineffectively, they forbid people from modifying it or doing anything with it because they made this term that you just can't obey.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly the same scenario they run into if they put pure GPL on the Visual Basic program.
Mm-hmm.
Because downstream, the person says, great, GPL gives me the right to copy, share, modify, and redistribute the software. I want to give it to my friend and give him a modified version. The problem is, to make a modified version and to build it into a binary, you've got to combine it with these proprietary libraries. Well, you don't have permission from Microsoft to do that.
Right.
So you're stuck. So the fact that the original copyright holder did what he was allowed to do and licensed under the licensee, well, pleased, was all well and good until it got to the next person. The next person was stuck because he now had obligations to two different parties, right?
Right.
He had obligations to the original author who said GPL, and he had obligations to Microsoft, which said proprietary or die, or whatever it is they say. So
what did you do?
Well, so what ends up happening, I didn't actually do this. This problem was solved before I got there, so it was an FAQ that I just sent to, I mean, honestly, what I did was include the FAQ answer and send an email back, and those, because, you know, I was just learning this stuff at the time myself. But the FAQ answer was very clear, and it used this idea of exceptions. What it said was, well, you GPL your code, but in addition to the GPL, you grant additional permissions. Now, and this is where the whole interaction with the licensing proliferation is explained. Because it's not that you're making a new license that does something different than GPL. You're giving the person all the permissions under the GPL. But you're picking an area of things that the GPL would otherwise prohibit and allowing them. So sometimes you can think of it as an spectrum. Because the whole time we were talking about this example, we were talking about just putting GPL in the Visual Basic Code, but what if we picked another free software license?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is what we're talking about generally. I think that the nice thing about exceptions is that you can tailor your particular license to whatever particular situation that you might have.
Right, but what, that's the point unusual. I was making is that sometimes you can look at the whole thing as a spectrum, right? So you have GPL on one end, which is has all sorts of requirements, and then the BSD or ISC licenses on the other.
Right, or the or the I guess for our purposes of our podcast, I'll say do whatever the bleep you want license,
right?
So, which is just a permissive.
Right.
A permissive
so any license. Type of permissive license. Of course, if you had licensed your Visual Basic program under the ISC license, you wouldn't have had to worry about this library issue because the ISC license by default gives you permission to do anything that you want.
Right.
So it really wouldn't have been an issue.
Or most things.
Most things. That's true.
It's
not
very
anything.
Permissive, but
it's extremely
it does
permissive.
Have requirements.
Yeah, it does have some requirements, but those requirements are so easy to meet. You could simultaneously meet those requirements while meeting the requirements on the Microsoft library license.
Right.
So what the exception actually does, so this actually makes a big chasm, as it turns out. So if you think of it in terms of GPL on one side of the spectrum, all the way on the other side of the spectrum, you have this permissive ISC license, and then there's other licenses sort of in between.
Yep.
Apache, which is sort of closer to the ISC side, and LGPL, which is closer to the GPL side. But when you're looking at that spectrum, sometimes you don't want to just pick a point on that spectrum and say, that's where my license is, or I'm all the way at GPL, I'm all the way at ISC. You actually want to kind of use a scalpel and cut in exact permissions. So in the Visual Basic case, the way we ultimately solve it is we say, let's give a very, very finely worded permission that says, you have permission to copy, modify, and distribute this work and in combination with these Visual Basic libraries. And you're allowed to make the derivatives of the software that combine it with the Visual Basic libraries as they come from Microsoft.
And the nice thing about that is that then you're taking on a license that you understand. So you're using a license that is written in a way that you and others understand and can be interpreted in ways that are established and that everyone knows about. But you can address situations that might not be a general purpose situations because, you know, each piece of software might have something, or some pieces of software might have some things that are unusual that in order to make it practical to share them under a free software license, you need to create some sort of special, you know, particular exception.
Right, and where this gets confusing, I think, for a lot of people is they do think in terms of the approved list and the OSI list and the FSF's free software license list, and they don't really see they sort of see this as an additional thing you're putting in, you're making a new license. But what you're actually doing is just adding additional things that you would have otherwise not been allowed to do. You're just sort of chipping away in the direction of ISC or Apache license or whatever by adding this exception to the GPL code. I think the reason it becomes confusing is because often when you download a software package, you're presented with GPL and it doesn't tell you about the exceptions. Right. And I think a lot of people get confused by that because they see, back in the old days, the standard way to make something GPL was you made a file called copying, which was a bad name in the first place, at the top level directory, and you put the copy of the GPL in it. And you said, and by saying that, you were GPLing it. And then exceptions, when they were written, and you had extra permissions that were beyond the permissions GPL already gave you, they were floating around somewhere in the source files, in the directories underneath the source tree. You know, so there'd be some directory called SRC where all the source would be, and each of those files might have different exceptions that gave you extra permissions.
Right, so it would be confusing to see what license your... What license it actually was under, because you might have some files that had an exception in it, but others that didn't. But actually, I think this actually might be something we can talk about in another podcast, a whole other podcast, because I think that this might this is sort of a general problem that sometimes happens with file.
Yeah, we definitely will talk about this whole issue of putting license notices in each file and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the reason people tended toward that practice, and I think it's a whole other podcast to talk about that practice, but they tended towards it because the GPL didn't really acknowledge that these exceptions exist. Because, of course, what happened in the V2 era of GPL was GPL was written.
Right.
Then the idea, somebody said, oh, we need this idea of exceptions, and then they were shoehorned as an additional thing. Now, of course...
So you had you had the license of the GPL, and then when you had these exceptions, it was a, here is an exception to the GPL. Right. So it was sort of pasted on after the license was already finalized and distributed.
Right, and that's what makes all these extra confusions, because of course you can't go the other way. You can't say, I GPL this work, but by the way, I don't give you permission to modify.
Right.
Then you've truly given the user a completely contradictory license and they don't know what they're allowed to do, because GPL says, yes, you may modify if you add what you think is an exception, which is in fact an additional restriction.
Right, so it's restrictions versus permissions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or restrictions versus exceptions, depending on the way you think about it. So, but it was still confusing because people would jump to the conclusion that, well, if I can give you an additional permission, why can't I add an additional restriction? You know, they think that they're two different things. Now, the great thing was that in the V3 process, we had the fullness of viewing the history of how V2 exceptions came to be.
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually both a section in V3 about restrictions and a section about exceptions. And of course, the number of restrictions you can add in the V3 world are extremely minor. They basically deal with issues of how copyright notices are maintained and that sort of thing. But the issues of exceptions are very broad.
And I, you know, as a lawyer, I love the way V3 is written, because there's the way that the additional permission section is written, which is basically a whole section that says, you know, you can add additional permissions, and here's how. And what's great about that is that it creates a framework for this practice that had been ongoing and very helpful for a long period of time. And what's really neat about it, I think, and, you know, maybe this is a geeky lawyer thing to think, but I really like how through additional permissions, you can actually make a license that was that seems more restrictive, like the GPL, seem more permissive. So some would argue that you could even use the GPL to replicate the permissions of any of the existing licenses.
Right, yeah.
So actually, the LGPL V3 is set up in that way.
Yeah,
because we have the GPL V3, which is a lot of people took the time to weigh in on how it was written and how it was structured and what it says. So everybody understands that, and then if you create additional permissions, then that sort of creates another framework on top of that. So it becomes, a much clearer way. But you could argue that you could go all the way to a permissive license from
indeed,
the
and GPL. there was a lot. In fact, when we were working on the V3 drafting process here at SFLC in collaboration with the FSF, there were actually jokes going around that we would go and rewrite every free software license ever written as GPL plus a bunch of exceptions. And of course, being a computer scientist, the first thing I thought of is Turing completeness.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea, well, I can actually express any program as a Turing function of strings and operators on strings and so forth. Or if you're more into the Goodle numbering thing, you know, I'm cool with that. You can represent any program with any integer, any positive integer. You know, it's that kind of thing where you have this system that allows you to represent everything that's representable. And in fact, GPL V3 gives that. So if you're a computer science geek, or actually a theoretical computer science geek, think of that idea of Goodle numbering or Turing machines and this idea that, well, GPL is actually an engine, or GPL V3, I should say, is an engine to create licenses that do the whole spectrum of free software licenses.
And in a way that everybody understands and is thinking about in the same terms.
Yes, yeah.
So it's, it sort of levels the playing field in a lot of ways.
Right. I mean, it's sort of like having your operating system. You know, you know that a Unix-like operating system is going to provide you certain APIs and certain types of interfaces.
Mm-hmm.
And the GPL V3 is the same way. It has a series of interfaces of how the licensing works. And then you could say, well, I want to turn that one off and I want to do that. So it's like you can create these, virtual sandboxes. You know, it's like in some ways it can be analogized to virtual machine stuff in the computer science world. If you have this thing inside the machine that's another machine that does something similar but different.
And one of the things that's also good about that is it encourages people to formalize exceptions that that may have been verbal or understood or said at one time. It creates a formal structure and Bradley is, I think, laughing at me because...
Well, I think the whole idea of verbal exceptions, and there was a long history of verbal, of a particular program having a verbal exception.
Which I think is no secret. So I think
we can
just simply say that it's the Linux module exception. I mean,
yes. Well, if such thing exists,
if
such a thing exists,
but having a formal process for additional permissions or exceptions, depending on how you think of it, you know, encourages people to, to formalize their exceptions. And there's a framework, and it's very clear how it fits in. And
I agree with that. And of course, you know, I've been begging, you know, I mean, you can find a recording of a 1998 USENIX where I begged Ted Cho to write down the Linux modules exception clearly. Actually, I think it was 99 now that I think about it. I think that encouraging people to write down the exceptions, the additional permissions beyond GPL they want to give is really important. And NV3, I think, does that. And the other thing you said is even the ones that were written down, there were cases, in a case we're going to talk about in our next segment, where they were confusingly spread across a large code base. And collecting those into a single exception that applies directly to the V3 exception system is just a great benefit to clarify the question about what the exception actually means and does, instead of having to chase it all the way across the code base where, you know, where it could have different versions of it and different ways of stating the same thing.
Now, I would be remiss, and I know we're going to go to the next segment in a minute, but I would be remiss as a lawyer if I didn't point out that there aren't actually a lot of situations that you'd want to create exceptions for. A lot of the times, there are very particular situations where you do want to create exceptions, but a lot of the time, GPL V3 or some other existing license really does do the trick for what you're looking for. So I just don't want our listeners to think that you know what they should do is they should think about the next time they're selecting a license, say, oh, well, I'm going to use GPL V3, so you know what exceptions do I need to apply to it? You know, GPL V3 has been designed to fit most of the circumstances you might encounter. So we're really talking about in certain particular situations. And to add a teaser, I think that you'll see the example that we're talking about in the next segment, and that'll make it a little bit more clear.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only thing I'd add to that is that you know, I'm looking forward. We're building a body of well-known exceptions, and I think that there's nothing wrong with having a menu of them. I mean, you know me, Karen. I'm so pro copyleft. I mean, I'm an AGP. Yep. I'm AGPL. I'm the leftist of the copy left there is, because I prefer AGPL even to GPL. But at the same time, I see that a lot of people are turned off by the strongest of copyleft. And if we have a body of well-known exceptions that when they decide, I don't really want full copyleft,
right,
it's a completely reasonable thing. And that's why, you know, LGPL itself, which LGPL is an incredibly popular license because people feel like it's the half, I've heard it called a halfway point, I was going to say, but people have called it the copy middle.
Yeah.
You know, and the fact that it exists and has that space, I'd like to see that space much more finely chopped up so that people can say, you know, I want this kind of copyleft. And I'd love to see there be a variety of copyleft. I hear
what
you're saying.
It's so interesting because I agree with you. I do. I just, you know,
we're about freedom, man. We're about freedom.
We're about freedom and we are about choice. But yes. I think that I think that people do need to think really carefully about what they're trying to accomplish.
Yes, absolutely.
And I don't think we want a situation where we're having license proliferation, but within the GPL, which is
Karen, that's true, but that's advice you should always get. You should always know what your license says, be it the license plus exceptions or the license by itself. I wouldn't want anybody to pick GPL without knowing what it did.
And that's something we can definitely agree on.
Yes. So we'll agree at that point and move on to talk about this specific exciting new exception that we want to tell you about.
Well, we're back, and we're going to take you out of your suspense.
I don't know if they were in suspense, Karen, because this was...
it's like 10 seconds.
Yeah. Well, and also, given it's a bi-weekly podcast, this has been over the news in the previous week, so people probably who are following this closely have read.
Probably understand that what we are getting at is a discussion about the GCC runtime library exception.
Yes, which, as I wrote in my blog post about it, it's been a 16-month process to write this thing. I spent myself 188 hours because I am pedantic and keep track of every last minute I spend on everything.
And I'm glad I didn't keep track of the hours I spent on it.
Because it probably was just as much.
And every hour was well spent.
It was indeed. And it was not just me and Karen working on it. Brett Smith, who was on a previous show of ours as a guest, spent a tremendous amount of time on it. The entire GCC steering committee spent time. In fact, the the thing has been under development for so long. When Richard Fontana was still at the SFLC, he started the project with me and Brett when he was still here before he went to Red Hat. So,
and of course, Richard Stallman and Eben Moglen, of course, also waited. Those names are
involved with anything related to free software licensing. In fact, it's Eben Moglen and David Edelson of the GCC Steering Committee who really deserve the credit for the idea itself of how the exception works. So the interesting thing about it is before we even had all that stuff we were talking about in the last segment, before there was an exceptions infrastructure in GPLv3 and all, and before GPLv3 was even started as a process, the GCC community was very concerned that they were falling behind technologically in the development of GCC because they were wanting to add a plug-in architecture to GCC to make it easier to write new optimizations for the compiler in a straightforward way, and there are other research compilers that have that feature already. And GCC was somewhat behind the curve on this. And the problem they had with it was because, you know, GCC is a project shepherded by the FSF, they wanted to make sure the freedom of the code base stayed. Now, the ironic thing about a plug-in architecture is that when you use the plugin architecture, you can find ways to avoid having your plugin fall into the GPL, which it's a bit of a surprise in some ways. I think so.
Actually, this was when I started working on this. It was a really big learning curve for me. Actually, if you would talk a little bit about that, I think that would be really helpful.
Yeah. So this idea of having a plugin architecture is great. So of course, plugins, you know, combine directly with the code. So it's not that the plugins themselves can be proprietary if the system is GPL'd. It's pretty much widely believed. I mean, some in the community disagree with that reading of GPL, but pretty much everybody I've ever run into agrees that if you have a thing that's designed to be part of another program and it's combined with it in a final binary like a plugin usually is, then it's a derivative work of the whole thing, and and you have to license it under GPL if the whole thing's GPL. Now, the thing is, you could write such a plugin that just did one very simple thing. Take the internal representation of the program, which when GCC compiles a program, it doesn't actually step-by-step go through every little piece of the C program and compile it. It generates its own internal data structure of what the program looks like, and compiler geeks have various different names for this. Sometimes it's called intermediate representation, or IR. It's what I called it in my thesis. Lots of people have different words for it that they use. But the fundamental thing is it's a concise description of the program designed to run optimizations on. Now, if you just wrote that out to disk, made it in its own file, you know, foo.ir, and then had some other program, separate, completely different program on the system, come along, pick up foo.ir and run optimizations out on it and rewrite out a new bar.ir that is an optimized version of foo.ir, then you've basically optimized the program with a completely separate piece of software that could be licensed under any terms at all. Now, all your actual GPL plugin has to do is know how to read back in that format.
Right.
And you've effectively circumvented the GPL simply by having something be written out to disk. And this is why, for years, GCC did not have a plugin architecture, because they were just too worried that if they added a plugin architecture, this would ghettoize completely the main code base, because everybody would just write these proprietary things and use a plugin that read and write the file format.
And this is sometimes a problem with trying to formalize licensing language or legal language in that way, is that sometimes you inadvertently create loopholes. And that's something that you want to avoid when you're dealing with something so important as software freedom.
Yeah, indeed. But we always saw this not exactly as a loophole. We never wanted GPL to be going beyond the scope of copyright. We didn't really want to have to do that. So of course, there was no way to take this problem head on, because we couldn't change GPL to say, well, you can't do that particular thing, because generally speaking, we think that sort of thing is legitimate, and we don't want to become like Microsoft, writing licenses that are overreaching and too broad.
That's right, but at the same time, you don't want to provide mechanisms to circumvent the GPL.
Exactly, so it's a very careful balance, but because of that careful balance, we had to think about the fact of how to approach it from another direction. And the idea came to David and to Eben that there's this special thing about compilers that goes way back to the original writing of any compiler, but particularly to the writing of GCC, which is that any compiler, ironically enough, copies part of itself into the final output binary program. Mm-hmm. Now, initially, this was a thing called CRT0, which was the piece of code that was enough to get the operating system able to load the binary into memory. But over time, CRT0 was not the only thing. There's a whole thing called libgcc, or mm-hmm. the runtime library, as it's sometimes called, that every C program brings in from GCC mm-hmm. into the program. Now, the exception, we talked about exceptions in the last segment, was written to allow you to take that code, put it into your binary, and license that binary under any terms you liked. Because we wanted the intention originally, way back when, we have kind of a royal
we under GPLv2.
Before, under GPLv2, back in the 80s and early 90s. It was the idea was, well, we want people to be able to use GCC to compile any type of software, right. even proprietary software. Mm-hmm. It was just a decision we made. We could have said, of course, the simple copyright rule would have said, well, hey, every program you compile with GCC must be GPL'd, or just don't use GCC. But that was, GCC would have never gotten adopted.
It wouldn't make sense for GCC and for its long-term success to do it that way.
Right.
Yeah.
However, because if we looked at the exception that we had and said, what about this other problem of the plugins? We said, Eben and David really said, what if we said every time you compile a program, you have to use only GPL'd software.
Mm-hmm.
And if you fail to do so, you lose eligibility of the exception. So it creates this weird thing where now you can compile all the proprietary software you want as long as you use a GPL'd compiler. But if you choose to use a mixed environment where some of it's GCC and some of it's these proprietary-ish plugins, not really plugins, these proprietary side programs that combine, mm-hmm. if you do that, then you must GPL the binary. So it creates this effect where the people who want to do proprietary software the most are unable to make proprietary compilers unless they want to GPL all their
right.
other work.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a rather roundabout way to approach the problem, but it was really innovative because it works within the exception architecture of GPLv3. It doesn't try to turn GPL into some sort of contract where you're promising to do all these things and making it broader than copyright law. It works all under copyright law
mm-hmm.
and actually gets the goal of basically creating such a disincentive to make proprietary side programs that combine with or work alongside GCC plugins that nobody will actually want to do it. It's pretty neat.
Oh, I think it's great.
But it's really complicated.
It's yeah.
I mean, like, I'm sitting here explaining it, and I'm worried we just lost everybody.
No, well, you know, I thought you did a very good job in explaining it, but there's a really good FAQ.
Right.
Actually, Brett did a really great job.
This is also like the probably you've heard me explain it to so many other people, and you've heard this explanation.
Well, it's funny because
and you've been working on it for 15 months.
That's certainly true, but we've been trying to bring you guys we've been trying to give you guys very basic explanations to licensing problems, and I think that that at least from this you get the flavor of what we're trying to do. And what's the reason why this started now, or why we're publishing it now after such a long time working on it, is because we started working on it right after GPLv3. Because with GPLv3 we got a whole new framework for adding exceptions, and instead of having them be exceptions, we have them as additional permissions within the framework of GPLv3.
Yep. So, but this is probably one of the hardest GPL exceptions mm-hmm. ever written because of this complexity to it. I hope we've given a certain flavor for it. And the language is very, very carefully drafted to actually implement that idea, because it's really difficult. That as hard as that idea was to explain,
mm-hmm.
implementing it is even harder. I mean, imagine like a large, complicated software system. You know, the design is pretty complicated, but that's just the design. Then you have to go and actually code the thing up. And that's basically what we did. We took this idea that David and Eben came up with, and, you know, first me and Richard and Brett and Stallman, and then later me, Karen, and Brett and Stallman, you know, worked mm-hmm. and worked at it and reworked the language, and then we put it in front of the steering committee, and they had good suggestions and ideas, and then we had to take it back. It's just been a very
long... One of the things that I love about working with the FSF is that the FSF and Richard Stallman in particular, but the FSF generally demands that their licenses be clear,
mm-hmm.
and that that no matter what, people should be able to understand them when you read them. So when you look at this, it is very complicated, but I think actually the language is quite simple.
Yeah, I'm laughing because in fact, it's not just that it's clear. They really want it to be clear for hackers. I mean, this is something that RMS has always felt very strongly about, that licenses ought to be understandable and accessible to free software developers, not just lawyers. So there were moments where some of Karen's language was said to be a little too lawyerly.
Is thinking in particular of a comment that read something like, "Our wording should be clear for hackers, not just for lawyers."
I think it said clear for everyone.
Clear for everyone, not just lawyers. And I actually thought it was pretty clear.
Yeah,
it's exactly the right thing to think constantly when you're writing an exception. It should be clear and everyone should understand it.
Yeah, it's definitely true. There's no reason you should need a law degree to understand how these exceptions work, and the concepts are very complicated. I think it's most difficult if you don't understand a lot about compiler technology, mm-hmm. and that's what my master's degree is in, so I have this extra background. But I think it's even hard for any hacker, not because the legal language is hard to understand, because the technical concepts, if you haven't done a lot of compiler work, are really tough. But because the GCC steering committee, they actually got it right away and had great suggestions right away, because they understand the compiler technology so well.
But I think even if you're not that involved in compiler technology, I think even if you look at the GCC exception now, I think you'll get a sense of exceptions generally, and also understand how we might write other exceptions,
mm-hmm.
To cover other situations using the same framework and the same wording.
Yeah, I agree. And there's a whole bunch of, if you look at my blog post on the subject, you'll find it on the softwarefreedom.org website. You'll find links to all the FSF and SFLC announcements about this. So you can read the full text. You can take a look at the FAQ, which is really great, and learn a little bit about it. And also, just to wrap up on the whole idea of exceptions, take a look at LGPLv3 and how it's written.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually, if you want to learn more about this stuff, I would suggest reading GPLv2, reading LGPLv2. Sort of getting an understanding of those. Then read GPLv3 and then read LGPLv3. And you'll see the interaction of how we were able to use exception language to get the same goals of LGPLv2, but in a much more concise and really clear way than LGPLv2 was able to get, because we've written it as part of this new exception structure for GPLv3.
And then to give you one more assignment, if you wanted to, if you were looking at GPLv3.
We're not going
to
grade anything.
Well, no promises.
I'm not grading anything. I've graded enough papers in my life. Students cheating. I've had it all. I was a high school science teacher.
No grades, but maybe
I'm not doing grading anymore.
Perhaps pop quizzes.
We're not going live. You already said we can't go live. So
I did. But what I was going to say is that if you want to take a look at the restrictions section and the permissions section in GPLv3, that really gives you a feel of what GPLv3 is contemplating and how exceptions can work within that.
Mm-hmm. And I want to thank everyone for listening and remind everyone that you can write to us at podcast@softwarefreedom.org. We do have one question pending that we'll get to next week. And you can find us on Identica. I'm there regularly, Karen, not so much. But if you want to say something to Karen, you can say it to me and I'll proxy it over, of course.
Or you can send it to podcast. That's anyway, true. We'll see you next time. I've already signed off, Bradley.
Right. Thanks, everyone. See you in 2 weeks.
Bye.
The Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license.